hands rather than grand gestures. "I'll overlook your poor hospitality," Haverford said, pouring two glasses of brandy, "because you are road-weary, and a travelling coach is nowhere to spend a honeymoon. What were you thinking, whisking the lady from town like that?" He passed Sherborne a glass, then raised his own. "To wedded bliss." Sherborne drank to that.
"I was thinking to escape London before I went mad."
"You wanted to see how the mine is progressing." An accusation from Haverford, who was sceptical of all industries not mentioned approvingly in the Old Testament. Sherborne had wanted to get Charlotte home before autumn turned to winter.
"The lady's family specifically asked that we wed by special license. If they couldn't be bothered to gather for the nuptials, then why linger in town?"
Haverford tossed another square of peat under the fire in the library's hearth.
"Did you, perhaps, anticipate the vows? I'm told that's something of a Wyndham tradition." "That is none of your grace's bloody business. But no, we did not anticipate our vows. I'll thank you to stop wasting my peat,"
said the man who's mad to dig a coal mine. "And we're family now." Haverford was smirking again.
"Your business is my business."
Haverford used the cast-iron poker to fuss with the fire, and Sherborne wrestled an urge to toss the Duke into the corridor. Haverford was a healthy specimen, dark-haired, tall and fit, but Sherborne was an expert on the proper use of the element of surprise.
"I come home," Sherborne said, "my new bride at my side, and then she's not at my side. She's disappeared to do God knows what with a sister she's had nearly 3 decades to gossip and conspire with. They saw each other at your own wedding mere weeks ago, and when I asked Her Grace to oversee a bit of tidying up here at Sherborne Hall, I did not expect her to kidnap my bride on my very doorstep."
Haverford put down the poker and lounged against the mantel, as if he owned the house, the grounds, its fixtures, outbuildings and livestock.
"Been going short of sleep, have you? Tending conscientiously to your marital duties?" "I have escorted my lady wife more than 150 miles along the King's Highway in less than favourable weather. You will please collect your wife, and don't allow her back on this property for a week. Perpetual absence on your part would be a singularly insightful wedding gift."
Sherborne took another sip of his brandy. Only the best quality graced his decanters, when he wanted to hurl his drink at the wall. Was a quiet meal with his new wife too much to ask? A little privacy to show her about her new home? A chance to think through her disclosures in the coach? Charlotte's tale of illicit love gone awry was significant. Whoever authored the downfall of Charlotte's friend had, in a sense, ruined Charlotte as well, for much of her innocence had died with her friend.
"That is not the expression of a man contemplating marital bliss," Haverford said, wandering away from the fireplace. "Give the ladies time to visit over a pot of tea. Elizabeth was ecstatic to learn of your engagement to Charlotte, and my Duchess should be allowed a chance to interrogate her sister."
Sherborne settled himself onto a sofa that had learned his exact contours years ago.
"Sisters interrogate each other?"
Charlotte certainly hadn't had many questions for her new husband. Haverford appropriated the middle of the same sofa, which caused the cushions to bounce.
"Are matters off to an acceptable start between you and Mrs. Sherborne? Again, this is none of your business, but because you will pester me without mercy until I gratify your vulgar curiosity, I hardly know if matters with Charlotte are off to an adequate start."
Haverford propped his boots on a hassock.
"Then they are not. If a woman is pleased with her new spouse, he'll know it until he's sore and exhausted."
Sherborne was sore and exhausted.
"You have been married a mere handful of weeks, your nosiness. You are hardly an expert on holy matrimony, much less on Charlotte Sherborne."
The name pleased him. He hoped that some day it pleased his wife.
"I am becoming an expert on how to make my Duchess happy. I suggest you apply yourself to the same subject regarding your own spouse. The wife who agreed to marry me only after we'd been found in a compromising position by their graces of Morland, the same wife who, 5 minutes previous to their graces' untimely interruption, had been telling me I did her a great honour, but to take myself the hell off, that wife?
Haverford rose and brought the bottle to the sofa.
Dear me, Sherborne, how does a woman who's refused your suit manage to be in a compromising situation with you 5 minutes later? That's like no sort of refusal I've heard of.
A comforting thought that had kept Sherborne company in an otherwise unforgiving saddle. He held up his glass, and Haverford obliged with another half-inch of his host's brandy.
You don't accuse me of forcing her. I'm not stupid, and Charlotte Wyndham would have had your tallywags in a knot before you'd so much as kissed her, had she been unwilling. Consenting to a kiss isn't the same as consenting to marriage.
Which thought had also kept Sherborne company in that unforgiving saddle.
She did consent to the marriage, too, didn't she? This is excellent brandy, if I do say so myself. I sent a case over to the castle to remark the occasion of your marriage. Do you have any bastards, Haverford?
Haverford set his drink aside.
I beg your pardon. We're family now, God help us. Your business is my business. I have no illegitimate offspring. What about you? None. Why doesn't the Duke of nearly ancient years have any byblows? Polite society hasn't grown that priggish, has it? Sherborne, the Duke said gently, you are married to the granddaughter of a duke, the sister of two duchesses, the cousin of countless titles. You are now polite society, which ought to restore anybody's faith in miracles. I haven't any children born out of wedlock, because they and their mamas cost money and create complications. I'm none too wealthy, and prefer to avoid needless drama. So byblows are still acceptable, and turning one's back on them is not. You've become a quick study. Morland himself raised a pair of byblows with the ducal herd. If a man takes responsibility for his actions, society tolerates the results. If he doesn't, he's no gentleman.
Then society must know nothing of the affair that had resulted in the ruin of Charlotte's friend.
I assume you've looked in on the colliery, Sherborne said. How do matters stand there?
Haverford took that bait. The Duke had resisted allowing any mines in the valley until he and Sherborne had reached a compromise. One mine developed along Haverford's notions of the valley's best interests. The Duke refused to own shares in the venture, which made his informal oversight disinterested. 90 minutes later, Sherborne was finally escorting Haverford and his Duchess to the front door. Charlotte did look a bit more the thing for having been closeted with her sister.
"Did you have a peek at your bedchamber?"
Her Grace asked as she kissed Sherborne on the cheek.
"I'm sure it's lovely,"
he replied. Haverford held out Her Grace's gloves.
"Stop whispering to my Duchess."
"We're family now," the Duchess said. "Whispering is part of the fun. Come along, Haverford. I have a few things to whisper in your ear as well."
They wafted down the steps on a cloud of connubial damned joy, leaving behind a profoundly welcome quiet. Sherborne both closed and locked the door, feeling as if he'd repelled a siege.
"They're always like that," Charlotte said, a little forlornly. "They were that way in town, too. I don't think they knew anybody else was at the church when they spoke their vows."
"I've banished them for a week. Have you ordered a bath?"
"That is a splendid notion."
"Let's have a tray in the library, and by the time your bath is ready, we'll have eaten."
Sherborne's library was a mere gesture compared to the collection at Haverford Castle, which meant the room was cosy. They ate in companionable informality, though Sherborne marvelled to think he could discuss ordering a bath with a female, and she regarded the idea as splendid rather than scandalous. Charlotte excused herself to enjoy her bath, and Sherborne used the time to go through the correspondence, stacked in date order on his desk. He gave Charlotte an hour,
52 minutes, the soak, then made his way to the ground-floor suite, now serving as the master bedroom. He found the new Mrs. Sherborne, swaddled in his favourite dressing-gown, fast asleep in a chair by the fire.
"Thus begins the wedding night," he murmured.
Mrs. Sherborne slumbered on. After he'd warmed the sheets and pillows, Sherborne scooped her up and deposited her on the bed, dressing-gown and all. He tucked the covers around her, blew out the candles, banked the fire, and went back to the correspondence, waiting for him in the library. Charlotte slept like a debutante after her court presentation, felled by profound fatigue and relentless worry. Her first thought, before she'd entirely awakened, was that she was near the ground, the safest place to be. She opened her eyes and was greeted by unfamiliar surroundings, and yet the sense of being anchored, rather than one or two floors higher than she preferred, would not leave her.
"Mr. Sherborne said to let you have your rest, ma'am. I've kept the tea hot, and there's chocolate too, if you prefer."
The voice belonged to a giantess of a maid, and she'd spoken in Welsh. "I'm in Wales, in my husband's house, in my new house."
"We're on the ground floor, aren't we?"
Charlotte could hardly recall arriving, though Elizabeth had been on hand, and then there had been enormous trays in the library, to which Sherborne had done swift justice. Charlotte had enjoyed a lovely hot bath.
"Right you are, ma'am. The footman had a time moving the furniture downstairs, but Her Grace got us organized. Would you like breakfast in bed?"
The bed was huge, and singularly lacking in evidence of another occupant.
"I'll use the table by the window. What's your name?"
The girl, for she was quite young, despite her grand proportions, popped a curtsy.
"Heroine Jones, ma'am. Most at Sherborne Hall call me Heroine, because half the staff are Joneses."
Heroine meant sunshine, and the name suited her. She was plain and freckled, with bright red hair peeking from beneath a white cap. Charlotte struggled from the bed, and Heloine held up a dressing-gown Charlotte hadn't seen since she'd left London.
"You unpacked for me?" "Mr. Sherborne said we were to see to your every comfort. When he uses that tone, even lazy Owen Jenkins pays heed. Owen is ever so handsome to hear his mamma tell it. Handsome is as handsome does, I always say. Chocolate or tea, ma'am?"
"Let's start with chocolate. Owen is the first footman, if I recall correctly." Heloine made the bed and freely discussed her co-workers, while Charlotte munched on fluffy eggs and buttered toast. "Most call me Heloine" was not by any standard a London house servant. Thank the heavenly intercessors for that mercy.
"What did you mean, that the footman had to move furniture about?"
Charlotte asked, when the maid had laced her into a comfortable day-dress. Heloine tidied up the tea-cart, making enough racket to mortify any Mayfair housemaid.
"Mr. Sherborne sent word to the Duchess that the master bedroom was to be moved to the ground floor. Himself takes an occasional queer start, and Her Grace says newlyweds must be indulged. Her being newlywed to His Grace, she must know what she's about, and she's your sister and the Duchess. So we did as we were told."
Sherborne had moved his bedroom to the ground floor.
"Heloine, you have made my first morning in my new home comfortable, and for that I thank you. Have you any idea where Mr. Sherborne might be?"
Town servants didn't expect thanks, and town employers would not ask the maid where the master had got off to. Town was 150 miles away, and for the first time Charlotte was glad.
"Mr. Sherborne has gone down to the works, ma'am, and best he does that while the rain has let up. I'd rather it snow, though Mrs. Moss says I'm daft, but I'm not. We've had nothing but rain for the past fortnight, and enough is enough. Snow is much prettier than mud, I always say."
The day outside had a sunny, blustery look that presaged changeable weather and swift-moving clouds. Like friendly servants, fresh air was another rarity in London, especially as the coal fires heated up in colder weather.
"Please ask Mrs. Moss to meet me in the library," Charlotte said,
opening one of two large wardrobes.
She was greeted with an assortment of waistcoats, shirts, and morning coats. One question answered. The second wardrobe held Charlotte's effects. She wrapped her favourite plain wool shawl about her shoulders. "Tomorrow you needn't bring both tea and chocolate for me. Chocolate will do." Aylwin gave her a curious look.
"Yes, ma'am."
Last night's glimpses at the house had left an impression of luxury on a tasteful scale. Sherborne Hall wasn't a castle, but neither was it a manor house with bare narrow corridors and more pantries than bedrooms. The appointments were spotless, the carpets bright, the corners free of cobwebs. The staff valued either their master or their wages, and the housekeeper was competent. The master of the house apparently set little store by his own life, however, for he failed to appear for either luncheon or dinner. The clock was chiming 10 when Charlotte gave up pretending to embroider in the library and returned to the bedroom. She dismissed the maid, built up the fire for the night, and started rehearsing her first proper rant as Mrs. Lucas Sherborne. The unforgivably neglected, furiously impatient, anxious beyond all bearing, Mrs. Lucas Sherborne. Thus far, Sherborne did not like being married. He liked his wife well enough, what he knew of her, but he did not like his household having been put at sixes and sevens by the addition of a female. His valet was nowhere to be found, when by rights Turnbull ought to have been dozing in a handy dressing closet. Sherborne's sleeping arrangements, his staff, his schedule, his everything was changing because he'd taken a wife. And there she slept, in the same chair by the fire where he'd found her the previous night. Sherborne washed as thoroughly and quietly as he could, and decided against shaving. As tired as he was, he'd probably cut his own throat and not notice until Charlotte scolded him for the resulting mess. Another night in the library beckoned, lest he waken at some ungodly hour and reach for his wife uninvited. "Mr. Sherborne." Charlotte hadn't moved, though she had opened her eyes. Cats did that, went from restful contemplation to poised alertness merely by opening their eyes. "Madam, I apologize for waking you." Apologizing was a skill smart husbands doubtless perfected in the first week of marriage.
"Where have you been, sir?"
Charlotte's tone, one he'd not heard since he'd been in leading strings, rather woke him up. "At the colliery, where apparently nothing can go forward without my hand on the figurative plough. If you want to tear a strip off me for abandoning you the livelong day, now is a good time to do so, because I'll sleep through most of your lecture." He dared not admit that he'd been so overset by the state of works that he'd lost track of the time. Charlotte rose and came closer, bringing with her the floral scent of French soap. She wore a dressing gown that covered her from neck to toes, but the way she moved told him that beneath the satin finery she wore no stays or bindings.
"You had the master bedroom moved to the ground floor. Why?"
"Because my wife shouldn't have to be afraid, even as she dreams."
"Because you'll sleep better in a room without a balcony. If you sleep better, so will I."
His honesty earned him a small smile.
"What's amiss at the mine?"
"Everything. And it's not even a mine yet. My engineer claims he was laid low by an ague, but I suspect he over-imbibes, which was why I could hire him away from the works at Waxter. If something seems too good to be true, it is too good to be true."
"What about last night?"
Charlotte smoothed the lapels of his dressing gown.
"Were you at the works last night, too?"
"In his nightmares."
"I fell asleep at my desk in the library."
"Ah, but why did you fall asleep at your desk in the library? Are you having second thoughts about this marriage?"
"And third and fourth thoughts. Also married thoughts about the woman standing barefoot before him."
"I spoke vows, Charlotte. Second thoughts don't come into it."
She gave him a disappointed look. Too late, Sherborne realized he'd blundered into a verbal trap. If he'd answered honestly, yes, this hasty expedient union had left him with many reservations,
Charlotte would be hurt, even if she'd been harbouring similar doubts. If he professed a false enthusiasm for their marriage, she'd be disappointed in him for dissembling.
"If you have no second thoughts, Mr. Sherborne, you are the first newlywed in the history of marriage to enjoy certainty about nuptial obligations entered into under dubious circumstances. I have second thoughts."
After firing off that round of marital artillery, Charlotte marched to the bed, unbelted her robe, and climbed beneath the covers. Sherborne considered another night on the library sofa, another retreat into a bachelor's privileges, and rejected the notion. The library was chilly, the sofa lumpy, and the whole room smelled of peat smoke and books. Charlotte smelled much nicer, and she was his wife. Sherborne blew out the candles, banked the fire, draped his dressing gown over Charlotte's at the foot of the bed, a metaphor that, and appropriated the opposite side of the mattress. Some fool had forgotten to warm the sheets, which was probably a blessing.
"Tell me of your second thoughts, Mrs. Sherborne."
A gusty sigh greeted his invitation.
"Madam Wife, I'd like to hear your second thoughts, if you're inclined to share them."
On the other side of the bed, a good yard from where Sherborne lay, Charlotte shifted.
"I was prepared to endure you."
"Likewise, I'm sure."
"We are man and wife. I'm confident a fair amount of enduring will be necessary all around."
She stirred about some more. "I meant—" Sherborne waited. He was not up to this conversation at this hour, but the alternative was sleeping in the library, possibly for the next 37 years.
"I worried about you," Charlotte said. "The weather was fickle. You were gone for hours, and you didn't send a note. Men are pig-headed, and minds can be dangerous."
"You worried about me?"
The unhappy former bachelor part of Sherborne wanted to resent her worry, to see it as yet another burden, more proof that marriage was an undeserved penance. Except nobody worried over Lucas Sherborne. They worried that he'd call in their debts, accelerate a promissory note, reveal the state of their finances. They did not worry about him.
"I'll send a note next time I'm delayed. We haven't even dug our main shaft yet, and won't until spring at the rate we're not progressing. I'll show you around the premises tomorrow, if the weather's fair."
"Thank you."
He didn't want her thanks. He wanted to get to sleep, to forget this whole miserable bloody day, and wake up with his life back as it had been before he'd gone to London. And he wanted to wrap himself around his wife and know that he was welcome in her embrace. Sherborne pondered that insight for several long minutes.
"Charlotte?"
A soft sigh, and then, "Night, Bethan."
Now she was drifting off.
"We have only the one tub that's large enough to accommodate me, the one you were using last night. I wanted to bathe, but couldn't, and then it was too late to wake the staff. One shouldn't come to one's new bride in all one's dirt when consummating a marriage."
Sherborne delivered a few sincere blows to his pillow. His explanation had sounded like Haverford giving a Boxing Day speech at the Punch Bowl. Sherborne had bathed thoroughly before leaving the house that morning, and in the normal course would have bathed again before retiring. He was married now, and the normal course was nothing but a fond memory.
"I know you're awake," Sherborne said, stretching his chin up and scraping a razor along his throat.
"I'm admiring the view," Charlotte replied, from the cosy haven of the bed.
Some of the leaden fatigue of travel had eased, and she'd shared a bed with her husband for the first time. She was also getting her first look at him naked from the waist up.
"You don't use a valet in the morning?"
Sherborne tapped the razor against a porcelain basin and took another smooth swipe over his throat and jaw.
"I did without a manservant for years, and Turnbull has enough to do, seeing to my wardrobe. You don't snore."
"Neither do you.
though you talk in your sleep."
He shot her an amused look in the mirror, as near as she could tell. His left cheek was still covered with lather.
"I do not."
"You mutter about timbers, ventilation, and hoses. Very romantic."
"Very profitable, I hope. Would you like to see the colliery today?"
Charlotte would like to see her husband without his breeches. She was reassured to learn that she found him attractive in a semi-undressed state. Very attractive.
"I would, if it's not too much bother."
"No bother at all."
He was soon finished shaving and donning a shirt and waistcoat. Charlotte climbed out of bed to tie his cravat, and from a tray on his vanity she chose a simple silver pin to secure it.
"This is the most subdued waistcoat you own."
Plain black, though silk-lined and well-made. He had several more like it in the wardrobe, dark green, grey, brown. Charlotte had gone through his clothes press as well, finding that fewer than half of his waistcoats adhered to the peacock style of his London attire.
"A colliery is a monument to dirt, or mud, depending on the season. You'll take a chill without your dressing gown."
Charlotte was wearing a lawn nightgown that fell below her knees. Before she could assure Sherborne that she was warm enough, he draped her nightrobe over her shoulders, though she caught him glancing down and then fixing his gaze over her head.
"Oh. Oh. Do we ride or drive to the colliery?"
Charlotte asked, finding the robe's sleeves.
"Drive, given the dampness."
Halewyn interrupted with the tea-cart, and an awkward moment arose as Sherborne grumbled about the kitchen forgetting his damned tea, in their haste to impress the lady of the house.
"Share my chocolate," Charlotte suggested, taking a seat at the table by the window. "I'm sure the teapot will be on the tray tomorrow."
"It had better be,"
Sherborne muttered, taking the opposite chair.
"How soon can you be ready to leave?"
Charlotte set down her chocolate and threw caution to the wind.
"If you'll lace me up, 15 minutes after we finish our meal."
Husbands did that. Charlotte had been assured of same by no less than 3 sisters and 5 cousins. The look Sherborne gave her was wary and intrigued.
"Lace you up?"
"If you insist that we share a bedchamber, then you'd best be prepared to make yourself useful. I tied your cravat, and I assume you're capable of dealing with my stays. They're not complicated."
Sherborne applied strawberry jam to a triangle of toast and set it on Charlotte's plate.
"I can manage your stays. Wear boots. The colliery will be a swamp, given all the rain here lately."
Charlotte served him eggs. They shared the pot of chocolate, and the meal progressed in domestic tranquillity. Sherborne excused himself to let the stables know to hitch up the landau, and Charlotte chose an older carriage dress that was more comfortable than stylish. As it happened, Halewyn came back to collect the tea-cart, so Charlotte prevailed on the maid for assistance with her stays. When Sherborne returned, Charlotte was putting the finishing touches on her coiffure, a simple knot secured with pins.
"You managed without me," he said.
"I gather time is of the essence,"
Charlotte replied, rising.
"Shall we be off?"
He held the door, and Charlotte could read nothing in his gaze. Not relief, but not disappointment either. Chapter 8. Somewhere between pummeling the pillow, staring at the bed canopy by the hour, falling asleep to the sound of Charlotte's sighs, and waking in a state of procreative readiness well before dawn, Sherborne had had a brilliant insight. He was a married man. As Charlotte had said, no sensible person arrived to the married state free of all misgivings. His misgivings were the sort that would abate with time or grow worse. He couldn't think himself into trusting Charlotte's regard for him, and he couldn't talk himself out of his regard for her. He'd offered for her because he was convinced they'd suit. She'd refused him, and then she'd changed her mind. Women changed their minds all the time, as did men. Charlotte had put up with being hauled away from her family on her very wedding day. She'd barely scolded Sherborne for neglecting her on her first day in her new home. She'd worried about him. The image that stayed with Sherborne on the chilly drive to the colliery was Charlotte, barefoot, her nightgown dipping low across her bosom, while she tied a neat mathematical knot in his cravat. She'd fashioned it perfectly the first time, though even Turnbull occasionally resorted to fresh linen to get the look just so. The confluence of emotions assailing Sherborne as Charlotte had knotted his cravat had been uncomfortable. Desire, affection, protectiveness, tenderness, joy, and some messy, inconvenient yearning that blended all of the above. Maybe Haverford had a word for it, and not that Sherborne would inquire.
"Can we see the works from the house?" Charlotte asked.
"Yes, though only from the upper floors of the east wing. By the lanes the distance is nearly a mile and a half. Across the fields it's less than a mile."
"I read about coal mining yesterday. You have many books on the subject."
Was that a rebuke for leaving her unattended?
"Feel free to add to the library, so the collection reflects your interests as well as mine."
"Elizabeth is the bookworm. Has she driven you daft with her lending library scheme?"
"Yes."
Daft and somewhat short of coin. Sherborne had agreed to finance Her Grace's charitable libraries, in part as consideration for Haverford's acceptance of the mine.
"Then you must assign the library project duties to me," Charlotte said. "Elizabeth means well, but I won't allow her to ride roughshod over common sense. She'd turn every schoolchild into a literary critic, and leave the nation devoid of farmers, laundresses, and other useful people."
"You have no interest in libraries?"
"Neither do you."
A gentleman didn't argue with a lady when she was right. Instead, Sherborne handed his wife down from the landau carefully, making quite certain she had her footing before he dropped his hands from her waist. As she linked arms with him, he came to another brilliant insight, this one not half so cheering. Their marriage would best be consummated at the time and place of Charlotte's choosing. For both of their sakes, she should not merely endure his attentions, but welcome them.
"You're constructing houses of stone?" Charlotte asked, as he guided her along a gravel path. "That has to be costing a fortune."
The works were a warren of cart tracks, stacked supplies, excavations, and tents. Heavy machinery sat under tarps, and some of the property was staked with ropes and cords. An enormous pile of building stone lay in a great grey heap beyond the tents. Why on earth had he thought she might be interested in any of it?
"We have lumber here in Wales," Sherborne said, "unlike most of England. But we have stone in greater abundance. Stone dwellings will last, whereas anything constructed of wood falls prey to the elements. Besides, stonemasons are easier to find locally than carpenters, and local craftsmen will do a better job than itinerants."
"You've even accounted for kitchen gardens."
Tidy rectangles had been laid out with twine behind where the long rows of houses would stand.
"The Haverford's idea. And we're to have hogs, sheep and chickens, also a few dairy cows. The colliery will be an estate of sorts, an experiment."
A young man trotted forth from one of the tents.
"I beg pardon, Mr. Sherborne. Mr. Hannibal Jones would like a moment, if you can spare the time."
"Tell Mr. Jones," Sherborne began.
"Tell Mr. Jones that Mr. Sherborne will be along directly," Charlotte said.
The lad tugged his cap and darted back the way he'd come.
"I spent all of yesterday with Mr. Jones," Sherborne said, "and I left him with a list of tasks that's so long he ought not have the time to bother me today."
"You could hire a manager."
"Well, no, Sherborne could not. The basic idea, dig a hole, haul out the coal, was complicated by issues of drainage, ventilation, safe accumulation of the slag, and safe construction of the shafts. Miners, women and children included, died every year as a result of tunnels collapsing, flooding or catching fire. Slag heaps in the wrong position caused landslides, and abandoned shafts filled with water that then flooded the working portions of the mine. Even the housing area had a substantial retaining wall behind it, reinforcing the steep rise of a hillside.
"I will not hire a manager," Sherborne said.
"Not yet.
Managers have a way of creating more problems than they solve when an undertaking is getting started. They make independent decisions when they should consult me, and fail to show initiative about trivial matters. When the mine is producing a profit, then I'll find somebody trustworthy to oversee daily operations.
Above all else, managers cost money."
"Deal with Mr. Jones," Charlotte said. "I'll be fine on my own."
Sherborne would not be fine.
"Rescue me in about 5 minutes, please. Jones likes to spout numbers for the sake of impressing his audience."
"I'll count the timbers in yonder stack," Charlotte said, "or pace off the distance between the last house and the first garden. I like how geometrical this place is, and I can't wait to see it when it's a working mine. Where will you put the schoolhouse?"
"What schoolhouse?" "I haven't decided yet. Perhaps you'll have some ideas."
She smiled at him. Sherborne smiled back, and then, because a newly married man should be allowed to express a bit of affection for his wife when on his own property, he brushed a kiss to her cheek.
5 minutes, madam."
He moved off toward the main tent, though something, perhaps a lady's gloved hand, brushed softly over his fundament before he'd taken the first step. Charlotte saw a side of her husband at the colliery she would never have glimpsed in the library or the bedroom. Sherborne was passionate about his mining venture. All the fire and focus he could bring to a kiss expressed itself just as eloquently when he waxed poetical about cables, steam power, tram tracks, and drainage. His vision went on for miles and decades, to the point that his works would someday have a private dock for loading coal directly onto coastal barges. The mine was still mostly equipment and raw materials stacked under tarps, but Charlotte could smell that watchword of commerce in the air, progress. She slipped into the tent, perhaps 15 minutes after parting from her husband, and eavesdropped on an argument between Sherborne and a white-haired, red-faced terrier of a man who seemed irate about the mason's schedule. The tent was ringed with tables, and on every available surface lay maps, graphs, bills of lading, and technical drawings, all quite lovely, quite numerical.
"The damned miners can sleep in tents," the smaller man was saying as Charlotte perched on a stool. "They're accustomed to dwelling in the very bowels of the earth. Put the masons to building the tram now, so you'll have it ready to go in the spring."
Charlotte ran her finger down a timber merchant's bill. "Language, Mr. Jones?" Both men looked up sharply, as if she'd materialized from the celestial beyond.
"Beg your pardon, ma'am. Humbly, beg your pardon."
Charlotte rose. "Mr. Sherborne, won't you introduce us?" Her husband obliged, and stood by silently while Charlotte asked Mr. Jones a few questions. How had he chosen the scale upon which to draw his elevations? What had first interested him in engineering, and how had he been trained? Was there a Mrs. Hannibal Jones?
"Gone, these 5 years. God rest us all."
Sherborne took out a gold pocket watch, flicked it open, and snapped it closed. "You must miss her very much," Charlotte said.
"I miss her smiles, her cooking, well, yes, ma'am. After 22 years of marriage, I miss my Florrie powerfully."
"So you understand why the masons really ought to finish at least a portion of the houses before they start on your tram, don't you? The men will be happier if they're not pining for their families, and I'm sure Mrs. Jones would have agreed with me that happy fellows do better work. Of course, a temporary dormitory for the bachelors could be erected fairly quickly, but I'm sure Mr. Sherborne has discussed that with you."
Mr. Sherborne was staring at his closed watch, though Charlotte knew he was listening.
"Right," Mr. Jones said. "A dormitory for the bachelors, who are always the first to come around looking for work, and usually the least skilled, which means they are exactly the fellows to build my tram line."
"We'll discuss it later."
Sherborne shoved his watch into his pocket.
"I've promised my wife a tour of the premises. and unless I want her to get a soaking in the process, I'd best be about keeping my word.
Charlotte sent a wistful look at all the figures, charts, and tabulations.
A pleasure, Mr. Jones.
Sherborne had her out of the tent in the next 3 seconds.
A bachelor's dormitory isn't in the budget.
You expected all of your employees to be married.
I'm guilty of an oversight. A budgetary oversight.
Budgetary oversights apparently numbered among the deadly sins.
This is your first mine. How can you expect to get every detail right?
This was Charlotte's first marriage, but she suffered the same need to appear competent that plagued her husband.
Because it's not my first business, and all businesses require labour. Did I think the men would sleep in the trees?
He paced along in silence for some 20 yards.
This is why I should have taken on a partner sooner.
A partner, not a wife.
I beg your pardon?
A partner. Somebody who knows mining, as Lord Brantford does. I don't bother with tenant farms because I know little about farming. What to plant where and in what order, when to fallow, when to graze sheep in the valley, when to move them up to the hillsides. I have no interest in such undertakings. So I rent out my acres year to year to those who know what they're about.
Do you have an interest in mining?
Charlotte did, and she'd been at the colliery less than an hour.
I thought I did, but what sort of mine owner forgets that his men need a warm place to sleep between shifts?
Charlotte let her imagination roam over the heavy carts, stacked upside down in a neat bank, huge spools of cable sitting under an open-sided tent, a small mountain of gravel piled at the top of a grade where houses would some day sit. The site was muddy and deserted on this bleak autumn day, but in 6 months it would be bustling with people and productivity.
Might I have a look at your site plan, Mr. Sherborne?
If the children are using your schoolhouse during the day, the bachelors can set up cots and make a dormitory of it overnight.
My schoolhouse, he muttered, gazing off at the pile of gravel. I suppose my lending library will be housed in the same palatial edifice.
A lending library can be a few shelves of books to begin with, Charlotte said, taking his arm, just as a mine can be a few sketches and some ambition. Do you have unoccupied tenant cottages on your land?
3. My last tenants left a year ago.
Then use one of those tenant cottages for your schoolhouse dormitory. Or demolish the largest cottage and put the materials to use here.
Sherborne looped his arms around Charlotte's shoulders and drew her against him.
Nobody was about, though Mr. Jones was shouting in the tent 30 yards away.
Charlotte held her husband, the experience novel, for all she'd done it before. They stood in the middle of a muddy, unattractive worksite, under a grey, forbidding sky, and nothing of desire coloured their embrace. But something of marriage did. Something of hope.
"I'll have a set of site plans at the house," Sherborne said. "I'll be happy to show them to you. The best view of the works is from the top of that hill. Shall we have a look?"
He kept her hand in his all the way up to the summit. The trek wasn't steep, but the way was wet, and the wind became sharper the higher they climbed. When they reached the hilltop, Sherborne spoke for a long time about his reasons for choosing the site and for laying it out as he had. When he pointed over Charlotte's shoulder to indicate where the tram tracks would run, Charlotte relaxed back against him. His arm came around her waist, and he fell silent, a warm, solid wall of husband at her back.
"When I considered marriage at all," Charlotte said, "I saw myself stuck in a cheerful, tidy parlour, pouring tea for an endless procession of gossiping women. My husband would be off until all hours being fitted for a new pair of boots, or playing cards with his friends. Children would come along just as I was about to suffer strong hysterics from sheer boredom."
Sherborne turned her gently by the shoulders, and another embrace ensued as the wind whipped at Charlotte's skirts, and a fine mist threatened to turn to rain.
"It won't be like that," she said, wanting to laugh and cry at the same time. Laugh for sheer joy, and cry for the young woman who'd spent years dreading a dismal fate. With us it won't be like that.
Sherborne kissed her, with a restrained hunger that matched the rising wind.
Our marriage will never be like that. Not for either one of us.
She expected he'd turn Lucifer, and they'd hurry down the hill ahead of the next downpour, but Sherborne instead wrapped her close.
I've changed my mind about something, Mrs. Sherborne.
Lord, he was warm. You don't want the schoolhouse and the dormitory to be in the same building?
Hang the blasted schoolhouse. I told you that we'd consummate our vows at the time and place of our choosing.
What had once filled Charlotte with trepidation now interested her mightily.
Ours will not be a white marriage, Mr. Sherborne. You promised me the full menu of husbandly attentions.
The rain started. A soft shower, for now.
I will keep my promise, but not at the time and place of our choosing.
Thinking was difficult when a husband turned such blue, blue eyes on his wife.
And now?
We will consummate our vows at the time and place of your choosing, and I pray to the almighty powers that you choose to avail yourself of my intimate favours soon and often.
Charlotte's hems were a mess by the time Sherborne returned her to Sherborne Hall, but she didn't seem to notice, much less mind. When he handed her down from the landau, he and his wife stood for a moment, nearly embracing, regarding each other. He wanted her. He'd shown her that before they'd become engaged, but he also wanted her to want him back, and
mirabile dictu, she apparently did.
Despite the difference in their stations, despite the dubious beginning of their union, Charlotte was willing to go forward in good faith. Or so she'd have him believe. She beamed up at him as if he'd promised to buy her an entire jewellery establishment on Ludgate Hill.
Minx. Shall we go inside, Mrs. Sherborne?
She twined her arm with his.
I asked cook to make us a proper lunch. Hot soup, beef and ham, with all the trimmings. She said you eat whatever she puts in front of you, but that will have to stop.
You'd starve me.
Now that Charlotte had mentioned food, Sherborne realized he was famished.
I'd pamper you. The menus should reflect your likes and dislikes, because you are so invariably appreciative. Cook isn't sure what those are.
And here, he'd thought sending his regular compliments to the kitchen was simply good manners. As the groom led the carriage horses away, the front door of the house swung open, revealing the butler, standing militarily straight in the foyer. Sherborne considered carrying Charlotte over the threshold, then discarded that daft notion, but did set about removing her bonnet and cloak once he'd escorted her inside. A husband performed these courtesies, and now Sherborne understood why. They were an excuse to stand close to his wife and to touch her.
I like hot food to come to the table hot, Sherborne said, untying Charlotte's bonnet ribbons. And cook excels at that miracle. I like meat well cooked but not burned, which he also invariably manages. I like good wine, which Crandall here has a knack for choosing.
Crandall gave Charlotte's bonnet a shake, sending water droplets all over the carpet.
May thanks, sir.
Sherborne passed the butler Charlotte's cloak, and Charlotte began unbuttoning her husband's greatcoat.
"I like some flowers on the table," she said. "Nothing elaborate. One shouldn't have to peer around a centrepiece as if one were wildlife in the hedge."
She gave Sherborne a shove. He turned, and she slid the garment from his shoulders. Turnbull had done likewise numerous times, minus the shove, but the gesture had felt entirely different. Charlotte handed the coat to Crandall, then took Sherborne's top hat.
"Rotten weather."
Sherborne eyed himself in the mirror and swiped at his hair to erase the creases left by his hat.
"Let me."
Charlotte ran her fingers through his hair, as Crandall took an inordinately long time to hang their outer apparel on the hooks opposite the porter's nook.
Amusement and frustrated desire were an interesting combination. Sherborne clasped his wife's wrists.
"That will be quite enough, madam."
She merely wrapped herself about his arm again. "Did you know that the Wyndhams are great believers in naps in the middle of the day?"
"If you bestow any more such helpful insights regarding your family's domestic habits, I will not survive until sundown."
"Yes, you will." Charlotte went up on her toes to kiss his cheek. "It's tonight for which you must fortify yourself." And for the next 47 years, Sherborne had always enjoyed a challenge.
"Will you rest after lunch? I promised Jones I'd go back to the works. The old boy frets if I don't spend at least half my day arguing with him."
"Does he have an assistant?"
"He has boys to order about. They are less expensive than an assistant engineer."
Why were there no fresh flowers at Sherborne Hall? Autumn was advancing, but surely the conservatory had a few blooms yet. "If Mr. Jones should go visit family," Charlotte said, "or if he falls prey to another ague, who can find anything amid all the maps, papers, bills, and estimates littering that tent?" An extraordinary thought assailed Sherborne as he seated his wife at the table in the breakfast parlour. Charlotte would make an excellent assistant to Hannibal Jones. Her air of feminine authority would accomplish more than Sherborne's orders ever had.
But then, if Charlotte were on site at the works, Sherborne would be distracted by his wife bustling about and smelling of flowers the livelong day. "Prior to my London trip, I had a fair sense of where Jones had stacked which documents."
Sherborne took his own seat and sent the footman at the sideboard a glance.
"In my absence, Jones has become disorganized.
Or possibly a tornado had touched down inside the engineer's tent." The footman remained at his post, gloved hands folded, gaze straight ahead. "We'll start with the soup," Charlotte said, offering the servant a smile. "A small portion for me, though I suspect Mr. Sherborne is in good appetite." That salvo could not go unanswered. Sherborne lifted his wife's hand to his lips.
"I'm famished."
"Of course, ma'am."
The footman, Ninian Morgan by name, refused to meet Sherborne's gaze while the soup was served, but Sherborne's loyal servant was clearly amused. Charlotte used their first proper meal as husband and wife to interrogate Sherborne about the mine. When would it be operational? How much ore would it ship? What quality? How many men would be employed? Her appetite for information matched Sherborne's appreciation for the food on the table. She consumed facts and figures at a great rate, all the while asking how Sherborne liked this dish or that cut of meat. And to think he'd worried that they'd have nothing to talk about.
"Will you rest this afternoon?" he asked, as the plates were cleared.
As soon as the question was out of his mouth, he realized he'd put it to her once before. "Rest? From what?"
"From running all over the works with me this morning, hiking to the summit, braving the elements."
"Kissing me witless. This morning's outing, while interesting and enjoyable, was hardly taxing. I have lists to make, and I might pay a call on my sister." Sherborne rose to hold Charlotte's chair, and debated whether to steal a kiss now that the room was free of servants.
"Am I to accompany you on this call?"
Ask the condemned man of his jailer. "Do you truly dislike Haverford that much?"
"I resent him," Sherborne said. "He was born into wealth and consequence he did nothing to earn."
Charlotte patted Sherborne's cheek. "So were you. So was I. Which is why we must use our resources responsibly, and not squander them on fleeting indulgences." Sherborne stopped with her at the door to the corridor.
"I'm not a damned duke, and if I have 19 generations of sons, none of them will be dukes either."
"But the 21st might, Mr. Sherborne. While if I have 1,000 generations of daughters, none of them will ever be a duke. Women are half the population, but once we marry, we legally cease to exist, simply because we had the great misfortune to be born female. The highest ambition my daughters might have is to marry a duke and bear his children. Perhaps you'd like to trade places with me. I'm told childbirth is the most painful privilege known to, well, not man, because men never have to endure it." She blinked up at him, as if this were a serious debate.
"I will concede that I was born to significant privilege," he said. "I also work my arse off."
Charlotte withdrew the pin from Sherborne's cravat, rearranged the linen folds, and fastened them again. "Haverford spends his days lounging about on velvet pillows, then? I must take Elizabeth to task for allowing such sloth." Good God, she was dauntless.
"Maybe that's why I resent Haverford, because he's so blasted saintly. Farmers name their children after him, old women gossip with him in the churchyard, and he actually listens to them."
"Dastardly of him. What's the real reason you and he don't get on well?" The morning spent hiking around the worksite had left Sherborne hungry. This exchange with Charlotte taxed him in a different sense. His wife made him think, and not about the expenses involved in establishing a working colliery.
"Haverford owed me a substantial sum."
Charlotte made a yes, yes, and motion with her hand. "Now he owes you much less."
"Now he owes me nothing, because I forgave him the balance of the loan as a wedding present, tore up the promissory notes and sent them to him with a signed release. For years, though, he took it upon himself to improve this tenant farm or import that new strain of sheep. He employed half the valley in his great crumbling castle, and he kept the shops in the village in custom, feeding and clothing his army of servants."
"And?"
"And he could manage all of that because I forbore to collect on the debts he owed me. In a sense, all of his commerce and charity, every bit of it, was undertaken with my money. He's well-loved and respected, while I'm the modern-day Grendel, laying waste to a paradise of Haverford's making. I want to sink this mine, Charlotte, not because it will make me rich. It won't, though I expect it to be profitable, but because the land can't support all the families who dwell here."
She was listening, which was more than Haverford seemed to do.
"Haverford means well," Sherborne went on, "but he lacks vision. I can employ 100 men at that mine, while Haverford would have to come up with at least 20 farms to keep them in work. We aren't making any new farms, and unless we take to the Dutch habit of reclaiming land from the sea, we never will. Corn prices fluctuate wildly, but the world will always, always need to keep warm."
Why couldn't Haverford, a reasonably intelligent man, see that? Charlotte slipped her arms around Sherborne's waist and gave him her weight. What sort of reply was this? Sherborne stood in the doorway, awkwardly poised to hug her in return, then settling to the embrace for an odd, quiet moment. "You are a good man," Charlotte said. "I didn't think you were a bad man, but I'm glad to know that your ambition is not merely for yourself. In this, you and Haverford are the same. The welfare of your neighbours concerns you. You know it, and I know it." For her, that seemed to decide the matter. Sherborne rested his cheek against her temple. Her hair was still damp from the rain, and bore the fragrance of gardenias, a sweet, substantial scent that calmed him. Or perhaps holding his wife did that. She was warm and pliant in his arms, and abruptly the prospect of an afternoon spent yelling at Mr. Jones in a cold, damp tent held no appeal. Charlotte nuzzled his cravat. "One of the lists I'll make is of local families upon whom we will call. We are newly married, and thus socializing is required." They were to converse while holding each other right in the doorway of the breakfast parlour. Married life was a procession of revelations.
"I will endure the civilities if I must."
"You must. We will also have guests for dinner, and work up to a dinner party or two. At Christmas we'll have an open house."
"All of which would cost money." "I will try to contain my ebullient anticipation of these ordeals."
"'We will contain our anticipation together, Mr. Sherborne. "'I would rather be setting Mr. Jones's tent to rights "'than fussing over menus, "'but in pursuit of cordial relations with the neighbours, "'sacrifices